Hello, welcome to the We Stand podcast. My name is Kate Brennan Harding.
And I'm Orla Vaughan.
What's your name again?
Orla Vaughan.
Yeah, because sometimes people slag me off for how I say your last name.
Really?
Yeah, because I say
Vaughan. Well, they go Vaughan or something.
They say, well, I think most people say Vaughan. I've never heard Vaughan until I met you.
It's County Clare. Like, once you get outside of the borders, it's Vaughan. But once you're in County Clare, it's Vaughan.
Yeah, which is why I'm obsessed with getting it right and probably go Vaughan.
Fabulous.
Anyway, welcome to the We Stand podcast, episode one.
Where we know our names.
Yes, thank God. We are starting the series. Some people might be joining us who have listened to the pilot episode. If you have been or one of those people, thank you so much. We have a GoFundMe to fund this podcast series. And I think we both are, I can speak for both of us, like, it was phenomenal, the response that we're after getting. And the replies from people and the encouragement. And it certainly has given us inspiration, hasn't it?
Yeah, and to know that we're on the right track and that there is a need for this conversation.
Yeah. Now, this podcast deals with sexual abuse, trauma, childhood trauma. If you in any way are listening and find yourself disassociative or, you know, upset, take a moment to stop. Don't continue listening. I'm sure some people are listening to me going, of course I know how to do that, but actually some people don't. So self-care, be responsible. If you need to reach out or get help, in Ireland, there's a great service called CARI, which looks after adult services. And you can go to their website, CARI, CARI.ie, or you can phone them in Ireland, 1-800-477-477. There's numerous other outlets that can help you, but they would be the best ones to point you in the right direction. If you'd like to get in touch with us, we have an Instagram account, We Stand Podcast on Instagram. And Orla, what is the email address?
It's we.standpodcast@gmail.com.
And we would love to hear from you. We're looking for people who give us feedback and people who would sort of suggest what their story is like for them and the different ways in which we recover from trauma and we figure out what this whole thing is. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So earlier today, Kate and I sat down and we decided to press record and start from the beginning.
Yeah. We are telling my story. The parts of it are very heavy. So please mind yourself.
You and I have a lot in common.
Yes, we do.
One of the wonderful things we have in common is that we're big Manchester United fans.
Yes, we are.
And you told me a funny story about when you were a child, that your dream was to be the first female player for Manchester United.
Oh yeah, I really believed that that was possible. There was even, I don't know, do you remember Alex Ferguson? There was a news at 10 and I was so giddy for it. Alex Ferguson had gone to a training ground to see this young footballer play. And they were only about 9 or 10, I think. And he was like, oh, you know, you have to come, you know, somebody called him, so you have to come see this player. Anyway, he went to see them and discovered after the match that the young boy was a young girl. And he was like, she's phenomenal. And I remember just watching it going, it might be possible by the time I grow up, it might be possible, you know. Yeah.
And tell me, Kate, you're more well known for in music circles.
Yeah.
So where did this, like, what age were you? Does it jump into your head that you had this draw for music?
I think I was just, like, I was born, like, both my parents played music nonstop. There wasn't really a silence or a gap in the house because it was filled with music. My dad, you know, he was big into disco and he was playing Donna Summer, I Feel Love, when I was born, and would tell me stories about how when he came back from the hospital, he turned on the record player, opened up all the windows, and it was a really hot, balmy kind of day, even though it was September, and blasted hot stuff and I Feel Love all around the place. And he'd been playing it in the hospital. And I Feel Love is my favourite song of all time. As soon as I hear it, I feel like it's in my DNA. So I reckon they must have been listening to that all the time because there's no way I didn't come out dancing, you know. I like, that's how I feel about music. And my mum has such variety of tastes as well, like ballads, more the Irish music side of things, and then getting into show bands as well. And then And my mum was mad into the Pet Shop Boys and all the 80s stuff. She loved it. And I actually didn't when I was a kid. The 80s stuff, I was always like, ugh, that's weird. You know, it's funny that all the gay stuff I thought was weird. And it's ironic considering I am a big gay. But apart from Boy George, who I was my first record to insist, I made my dad go to Golden Discs in I didn't make him. He always went to Golden Discs every week. But I made him buy me Karma Chameleon, which I think he was probably disgusted by, but I was absolutely delighted, and that was my first ever record.
And had you big dirty posters on your walls?
My room was a box room, but it was full of men with big eyebrows because it was either Eric Cantona on one side and then the Gallagher brothers, and I was obsessed with all of them. So yeah,
all in Manchester.
Yeah.
And you were a bookworm.
I was, yeah, as early childhood I was a bookworm, or I learned to read really young. I learned to read and count. The counting didn't stick, but the reading did. And I think I know I was reading around the age of two and a half, and able to pick up books and read them. And then every present I ever got from family members were book tokens, book vouchers, and they were my favorite things to get. And then spend hours in the bookshop picking my next adventure series, or The Famous Five, or, you know, Secret Seven, all Enid Blyton stuff, and then Mallory Towers. And yeah, I loved adventure kind of books and books that took me away.
Did you enjoy school?
I did, yeah. My primary school was very different to my secondary school. I went to a very privileged primary school called Pembroke, which was off Waterloo Road at, in Dublin Four. And yeah, like, there was a couple of people to a class, but you had sort of two or three classes in one, so kind of like a country education. But it was multi-denominational because a lot of the students that we had in our class were, you know, their parents worked in the embassies. And, you know, I think I went there because it was a really good school, but also my dad kind of, more than my mum, but definitely my dad would have been wanting to look good. And we did all sorts there. We did speech and drama. Apparently we did waltzing. A friend of mine got in touch. Go, do you remember when we were being taught how to waltz? And I was suddenly, oh yeah. So I loved that school. And they did a great service for me in that my parents split up when I was in sixth class. And my dad, I believe, hadn't paid fees. And they let me stay and let me complete my primary education without wanting to traumatise me more.
Brilliant.
Because it was a place that was really safe for me. Mm. Yeah.
So that all sounds like a pretty normal, nice,
yeah,
childhood. And then you have, did you see a lot of your mum's family?
Yeah, my mum's family live in England. Mm. So my nanny, who's dead now, but my nanny would come over maybe twice a year, definitely once a year. My auntie Aggie as well would come over. The odd uncle would come over as well. And I always remember, you know, when my mum's family would come visit, especially the uncles. And like, this is the 80s, so it's fine for all the cigarette smoking, right? But it was cigarette smoke, and I never forget the breakfasts. Do you know, you had the white pudding, the black pudding, the sausages, do you know what I mean? And there was just something extra special about when they were over and that happening. It was gorgeous, and it was really loud. They're a really, really loud family. Whereas the opposite to the Hardings, who were really quiet. So, you know, there was something kind of cool about that. And my dad's family lived in Waterford, and well, my aunt lived in Bray, and my dad's family lived, the rest of them lived in Waterford. But you have polar opposites, really, you know.
So you'd see a lot more of your dad's family?
An awful lot more, yeah. We were going down to Waterford regularly.
What are your first memories of Waterford?
Well, they're hazy, because this is the thing. I have memories from really early childhood. I was walking before I was one, so I remember walking, holding onto a table to go to the next table. So, and I remember they didn't have a television, and they had a dining room, which is in the front of the house, and then the sitting room was in the back of the house, and there was books everywhere and a big chess table, and obviously everything seemed really big to me, but it was probably a really small room, because I went back and viewed the house, you know, a few years ago, and I was like, this is so much smaller than I thought it was. But yeah, it was very much, you know, oh, we read books and we're into art and we play chess, you know, that's the kind of lifestyle.
Environment.
Yeah.
And what is your first memory of your grandfather abusing you?
Whew. That's the thing. I can't tell what's the first memory. There's a flash of pain. There's being cornered in a room and being leaned on. Basically I can't breathe. I don't know what the pain is. And I can't move. But I don't know when that was. And I think that's a real struggle because I can pinpoint stuff when I'm a little bit older, but the earlier stuff is really, really hazy.
Talk to me about the fun fairs. They were great fun fairs.
Yeah, we would go often to Tremor, which had, the bumper cars, and I only really liked the bumper cars. I don't like things that violently throw you around, because, well, I had ear infections most of my childhood, so that's probably why. But yeah, we would go to the bumper cars. We go to Dunmore East a lot because the family were heavily involved in the RNLI there as well. They were, I think my granddad was, he was a member, as in they would go out on the rescue boats, and my uncle and my dad the same. But yeah, we'd go to Tremor. And I would want to drive the bumper car, and I would be maybe I was too small. I mean, this would happen quite often. I would be in the bumper car with my granddad, and my dad would be in the other bumper car, and I'd steer, but I mightn't be able to reach the pedal, so I might have to sit between my dad and my granddad's legs. And I remember sitting when I was younger, sitting between his legs and driving. But his hand would be under my knickers. And I would be looking at everybody and wanting to beat my dad and laughing. And all at the same time, this horrendous stuff was happening to me. And I was completely, I know that that is part of detaching from my body and hating my body and feeling let down by my body. And yeah, I mean, both of the, I really feel like I've split in two then. And I remember just looking at my dad at one point because I was about to overtake him, but I couldn't. I crashed into the back of him or crashed into something. And he was like, "Oh, you nearly had me," that kind of thing. It was all that kind of fun. And I couldn't because I was actually stopping. My granddad was hurting me too much, with his nails. And, there was another time when I was older and I could reach the pedals, but then I would be pressing down on the pedals and he would be doing the same thing again. I wonder if that's part of my insistence on wearing trousers so much, as a kid. He'd still abuse me, but that's just coming up there. I'm like, I was insistent on trousers from a very early age, but also that's probably just to do with how I express myself,
And you were a tomboy.
I was,
Yeah.
yeah. A gentle tomboy. I
Oh.
didn't climb trees.
Oh. Well, did you not?
No, I still
Excuse me.
can't. I still can't.
That is how very dare you be a tomboy if you can't climb a
I know,
tree.
I always feel like the prerequisite is, oh yeah, Kate was a tomboy, and I'm like, but I didn't climb trees. Because yeah, I don't know why I think that you have to be able to climb trees if you're a tomboy.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
Kate, so I know we've talked obviously outside of this and you're a wonderful child for detaching through your reading.
Yeah. And not just reading, sorry, Earl, I'm interrupting you, but like one of the big things, like I suppose if you go back in, right, so I had this really privileged childhood, early childhood, and at the same time I was being sexually abused. So there was two, it's like two roads that are going parallel with each other, and I had to traverse them both. And my parents are just driving along one road, and I'm on two roads. And there was a time when I was really small that I wouldn't answer my parents. And no matter what they would say to me, and I was actively not answering them, and I was pretending I couldn't hear them. And they brought me to specialists. I went to the eye and ear hospital for ear testing to see was I deaf, and like I wasn't. But it was, I still remember being inside my head going, nope, I'm going to practice this, And it was, and I, like that's all a part of, I suppose, not surviving it, but just sort of getting to grips with my world. That sounds weird, but that's what I remember
No,
being that kid. And then the other thing was I would get really, really into fantasy worlds, and you know, like we do a lot of driving, and so we'd be listening to music, but to the music I'd be setting scenes for myself. Do you know what I mean? In my future, or you know, what I would like to do and what I would like to achieve. And I would daydream and daydream and daydream, and I would be lost in this world and be totally happy in my own head in this world that I'd created for myself, you know.
And what did you want to be when you grew up outside of a Manchester United player?
Doctor when I was younger, definitely, yeah, a doctor, and to also work in radio, which is, you know, thankfully what I do. But it took a long time to get to that place, and I suppose through this podcast we might discover a little bit why it took a long time. I think a lot of people meander and then give up on themselves and think that they are not good enough or not worthy or sure. Why would I? What gives me the right to have a dream come true? You know. And I think that we can get ourselves in the way. We sabotage ourselves all the time to believe a story we've told about ourselves, you know.
What was your favorite book, Kate?
Oh, the adventure series. The adventure. Did you ever read the adventure series?
No.
It was Philip and Dinah and Kiki the bird, and it was the adventurers go to the island. I just loved that book. I said earlier that I had two roads travelling. By the time I was 9, I had three roads travelling because my dad had included me in a plan of his to leave my mum. And he included me in that for probably maybe a year, maybe over a year. His reasons around that, I don't know. He is, you know, I don't talk to him anymore. So the thing is, I had my mum and my dad, and that was a happy childhood up until a certain age. And obviously then the second road started, and then when I was 9, 10, the third road started. And the third road is me keeping another secret from my mum, me holding onto the fact that my dad had said to me that if he disappeared and his clothes were found on a beach, that I would know he was okay. Or in the car coming back from Waterford after I'd been abused, do I think my mum is seeing other men? I'm planting all these seeds, and because I trusted him and worshipped him and was very close to him, I felt protective of him, and he would be telling me how upset he was and how his world was falling would fall apart if I wasn't around, and you know, all this stuff. And now I know that to be really just psychologically emotional manipulation, and it's kind of terrible because I had my dad up to a certain age, and then I had this person who was using me, and so it has left me wondering what's real sometimes, and can I trust people? And I think I have a good judge of character, but I can end up in situations where I'm suddenly like, oh, for God's sake, how did I end up in this again? Do you know what I mean? Too not too trusting, but just I can be manipulated still. Everyone can be manipulated. It's just, you know, your weak spot, you know. So my dad's family were my dad, who was the eldest of his siblings. He had two brothers younger, and then there were three girls. One of his brothers died when I was one. And I have my granny and my granddad. And then on my mum's family, there's my granny, who was called my nanny. And then my mum's sister and all her brothers, and five brothers. And I just have to do that. Does she have five brothers or four brothers? Five. The family in England are all Irish. And I think there's something about emigrating to England in the 60s and 70s that probably makes you a bit more Irish than Irish. And my family in Ireland, even though they weren't Protestant, they were very Catholic. They had this very middle class Radio One vibe about them. But I think they were just sort of perpetuating that, do you know? My grandfather, who abused me, was a he made dentures. He had a practice in Waterford City, and my nanny in England, she played bingo and was a apparently a domino champion which I think is pretty amazing. And she was a cleaner and worked in pubs and loads of different things. So those are the two families that I come from. Yeah. And then my parents, by the time my parents split up, there was day, that was the third road. And that third road ran all through my teens because I kept, well, not all through, but for the start of my teens, because my dad wanted me to keep notes and keep track of my mum. He used myself and my brother to spy on my mum.
Kate, your mum, by the sounds of it, was completely ignorant to this. She had no idea she was splitting up from her husband.
None. No idea. They were fighting loads. I believe my dad was in debt. I only know from a child's view. And the day that my dad said, the day there's a horse box in the front garden is the day that I'm going to take your mum out and tell her that we're moving to Donegal and she can come if she wants. And he had been keeping me in this plan for months. Like, it was horrible just living with this complete anxiety around that, complete anxiety around... I'd gotten used to the abuse. There wasn't actually anxiety around the abuse. I know you're laughing because it's like, well, no, that was just, oh, grand, okay, do you know what I mean? I have to look at it like that because of, like... And then I was listening to 1960s music, Peace and Love, on the bus into school. Do you know what I mean? But, like, Dad told me that horse box would be there. My aunt came over. So our babysitter lived next door. She came over. And then my aunt arrived over because she knew, that my dad was leaving my mum. And I think they went out. I was very stressed but didn't show it. My feet were cold, which is a regular occurrence. If I'm very stressed, my feet go cold. And my mum came back in much faster because they got to wherever they were going, and then mum came back in and she looked wild in her eyes. And I remember saying to her, oh, he told you. And the look she gave me, and it was a look because it was absolute panic. It was like, what? Like, my mum and me have talked about that moment because for her entire world, she's like, what? You know, and then she comes back and her eldest daughter knows. She said she honestly, like, my mum has said that she honestly felt like she was in some sort of Hitchcock movie or something, do you know? Because it was so crazy. So mum had to go immediately and get an injunction to stop him taking us. And this is the thing, my dad was leaving my brother behind. He was taking me and one brother and not the other brother.
And why was he doing that?
Oh, because he didn't really... like my brother too much, and my mum's favourite and I was his favourite, which has really damaged the relationship between myself and my brother for such a long time and damaged my brother, you know. So I guess in this first episode you're hearing a more rounded approach, as in, this is the kind of family that I had, this is the kind of situation that my mum was dealing with, and I think was living with complete PTSD from it. And I still hadn't disclosed. And they split up and we moved very quickly into, my dad had not paid the rent, so we were being evicted. And we had moved into, we were living in a place called South Park, in which has the address in Fox Rock. It's actually off Cloncrane Road. It's a very salubrious area. And my mum moved to this Muse in Black Rock, down the laneway, which had no lighting on it. The house was gorgeous, but the thing is, my mum, they converted the garage into a bedroom for my mum, so like there was no underlay. My mum was freezing that year, you know, and my mum likes being warm. There's no heating. Like, it was, she was in the garage basically with wallpaper on it, and
had she the three of you with her?
She had the three of us, yeah. And then we started seeing my dad every weekend, but for full weekend, Saturday and Sunday. So he would drive the 6 hours from Donegal, collect us, bring us back up. So we'd spend the night on Saturday night in Donegal, and then the next day on Sunday we would be driving back to Dublin. My brother was not yet a year old. My other brother is 5, I'm 10. So we were driving up and down to Donegal all the time, and I think, like, I love driving, so I imagine that's just kind of a product of it. But I remember those journeys as well. I was still very close to my dad despite all of the awfulness. I was afraid of him, but I was also close to him. And we'd listen to music, listen to tapes. And, you know, I kind of felt comfort in it because it was like being around my dad when I was really little, when I used to make tapes to listen to in the car. So I guess there's that element of, there was always a bit of me knew at that stage that it's broken. But I was just a kid and just desperate for comfort, and I was attached to him more than my mum. So we'd go up to Donegal, and then, you know, my mum, that carried on for, I think, maybe a year. My timeline could be off on that. And I remember, I've talked to my mum since about, you know, like, what was it like, you know, the first few times letting, like, a tiny baby, never mind me and my brother, up every second weekend. And she said the first weekend that we went, she said she didn't get out of bed from the moment we left to the moment that she came back. And not in a good way, in a, I can't control this, the world is wrong, my kids are away from me. And like, this is at the same time that dad was not allowed to see us outside of those hours, and he hid behind a bus shelter in where Juries used to be in Ballsbridge, and brought me into the coffee dock there. And, you know, oh, I can only order a coffee for me because I have to go back to Donegal, will you have a water, and sit there for maybe 2 hours with them. I can't remember what he talked about, but I just remember it was all kinds of weird. And then I had still had to go back out and get the bus the hour home. And like, only recently I've gone, why didn't he just drive me home and drop me to the end of the road? Do you know what I mean? And mum couldn't see. And I had to keep that a secret. And it was all keeping secrets. Yeah, like, it's funny talking about this stuff around my dad, but I think it's really important to build an entire picture rather than this outwardly looking really lovely family. You know, quite, you know, my parents are good looking. There was the three kids. There was the salubrious address, albeit not paid for. There was the BMWs. There was going to the posh school. There was all of the things, you know, and then there was all of these different levels of my life where I had to keep secrets. Dad would take us to Donegal. There was quite a long time where myself and my brother, my middle brother, so my brother's 5 years younger than me and my other brother's 10 years younger than me. And my middle brother and me would be sat down and we would not be able to move, because we had to dictate what our mom had done for the week or 2 weeks, who she had seen, whether there's any people in the house. And this was all sort of done in terms of, I'm only trying to protect you, there's strange men around, blah, blah, blah. But it wasn't, it was really, really manipulative and it was really awful. And my brother, he started telling things that weren't true because he was just trying to get my dad to like him. I had started keeping a diary and hiding it under the bath. My mum found it. It was awful when she found it because she knew I'd been telling dad stuff about her. And it was awful. If we didn't feed him information, he'd shout at us and he would stand in front of us and he would be so like desperate to get anything. And
did you feel, were you in the same circumstances as your brother that you made up stories as well?
No, I didn't make up stories. And I did say that's not true. And Sam and me were always set up against each other, which is really unfortunate, you know. And you're a kid and you don't understand that. And he's a kid and he's much younger than me. And his entire world is like, he's 5 developmentally. Do you know what I mean? It's like, what the fuck? And also, this is a little boy that witnessed me being sexually abused, do you know, when he was under 5. I don't know what age, maybe he was 3. I'd say he was 3. It's hard to tell. He was a real stocky little fella. But like, that's why I remember that incident as being one of the worst incidents. But it's also, I kept remembering sexual abuse happening to me when somebody else was involved. When I say somebody else, I mean my grandmother witnessing it. I mean the people in Tremor looking at me. They didn't know what was happening, but looking at me. I mean, you know, like my brother bursting in and stopping my grandfather raping me. Do you know what I mean?
Talk to us about that time with Sam when that happened.
Well, in the house in Waterford, there was an extension, an attic upstairs. And back then there wasn't styres and stuff like that. And they didn't build a proper stairs. They built this wooden kind of stairs. And there was no edge to it. So you could just fall out the side. And obviously it looks really, really high up from when you're a kid. It is really high up. But like, I know my memory of it is like, oh my God, this is 100 feet up. Anyway, I was in the attic, and my grandfather, there was a few beds in the attic, as in like it's where extra people stayed or whatever, and it's where we stayed when we were there. There was a mattress on the ground, a double mattress on the ground, and then there was a single bed to the left of the room. And there was a big, you know, those kind of big windows. I don't know what to call them. It doesn't really matter, but they jut out from.
Are they dormer windows or something?
Kind of, yeah, they are. They're dormer, yeah. So they jut out, and my granddad he brought me up there, but this was one of the times where I can only use the term, and I hate using this term, but I'm desperate to come up with a different word. It was like lust filled. He was overtaken. He actually couldn't contain himself. And my brother had come up the stairs after us, and he locked him out onto the landing. So I was terrified because my brother could fall through the gap down the stairs. That's all I was worried about. And my grandfather was obviously in a hurry to do what he was about to do to me. So he lay me down. Well, he pushed me onto the mattress that was on the ground, and he got on top of me. And he, you know, I couldn't breathe. I couldn't breathe because he had full weight of a man on me, but I couldn't breathe because he also was sticking his tongue down my throat. I was wriggling because I thought I was going to die because I couldn't breathe. His fingers were pulling at me and were inside me, and he was trying to do more things. And I, like the feeling around that, I know this is very hard for people to hear, but the feeling around that, I can feel myself stop breathing while I'm talking. Do you know what I mean? It's like this tense. And my brother broke the door to get in. I said earlier he was stocky. It was really good. He was stocky. He broke the door to get in. And he saw my granddad on top of me. And my granddad stopped. And I remember my brother looking shocked. But that's... he had no comprehension of what was happening, but I think he obviously was like, what are you doing on top of my sister? And I think he went and kicked him. I think he went and hit him or kicked him. And my granddad got my brother, and he threw him because it's an attic conversion, there's these tiny little parts at the either side of the walls where you could use for storage. And my granddad threw him in there and closed the door on him. And we were really scared of those places anyway, because we were told there was mice, etc., you know, and spiders, and we were both scared of spiders. And so he screamed and screamed and screamed, and he got him out, and he was like, if you tell anyone, or if you act up like that again, you're both going there and you won't come out and your parents won't come and find you. And I don't know if my brother remembers that. I've spoken to him recently about it. He kind of remembers it. He didn't want to remember it for a long time, obviously. I think that's the single most traumatizing thing that happened to him at that age. And for me, I just remember we all went back downstairs and sat down in the sitting room that I described earlier with the chessboard, and I started to play chess with my grandfather. And that was that. Sorry.
No. Jesus. All the chess thing. Do you want to take a break?
I'm okay.
Okay.
Do you want to take a break?
No, I'm fine, but just... that's not the first time I've heard that story.
Yeah.
It doesn't improve. it just send, and it, when you describe there about your body, you know, like as I'm saying this, my whole body, like my 2 feet are like 2 anchors on the ground, mm. like 2 things of cement, and I'm only listening to you. So
I think the thing as well Some people might be listening to this going, why are you telling us this? Why are you going into graphic detail? Some people might be listening to this identifying with the story. Some people might be listening to this wanting to throw whatever they're listening away. Some people might be listening to this that know me and might view me differently, you know, and that's been a fear of mine for years. But the thing is that every time I speak about this stuff, I get messages of similar experiences, shared experiences from people who feel that they can't speak. And I sound like, I don't want to sound fucking self-righteous or anything like that, but I just know that that helps me because I know there's way more of us than there are of them. And it's not something to be ashamed of. It wasn't me who did that. It wasn't me who abused me, you know, and that's the thing I thought for years. I sort of acted for years as if it was me who abused me. It was a grown man in his late 60s and 70s who abused me. And it was shit.
Mm. Kate, do you think that was one of the last times you were abused? Uh-oh. No.
No, I'm only, I'm 5 years older than Sam, so what's 3 and 8?
Okay.
Yeah, no. No, yeah. No, no. And the thing is that, like, I suppose, like, there's earlier times where I kind of, like, there was my communion, which was before that. There, you see, there's all the family occasions. And then there's the added thing where I was my granddad's favourite, and aren't they very close?
Mm.
Which we spoke about, I think, in the pilot episode when we talked to my grandmother who knew that the abuse was going on. If you haven't listened to the podcast, my grandmother knew. She caught my grandfather abusing me. But, like, then there was a time when I was 10. Well, I wasn't. I was 9. I was a month off being 10. And my cousin was getting christened. And we were back in my aunt's and uncle's house, and I was sitting on my grandfather's lap, and he had his hand up my dress, and everybody was there. And actually, like, your kitchen here, which has a, what do you call that, just a window into the kitchen, you know, it's like, you know, a hole in the wall. My dad and my aunt were in that kitchen looking out at me, and my aunt has said to me since I was a teenager, she said to my dad, that doesn't look right. So, you know, I knew other, it's almost like people could see something. And all the while, like, I just have this smile on my face, a mask.
What was it like for you, Kate, when there were occasions, the family occasions, and that it was announced, oh, next week we're going down, or tomorrow we're going down? Do you know, were you, was this sense of dread, or was it like,
I honestly can't,
yeah,
I can't attach to anything other than being more happy-go-lucky, looking forward to a drive. We'd eat nice food when we were down there. It was always concentrating on that stuff, and that at some point I'd have to get the abuse out of the way. So I guess the thing around who am I, it's who am I, who is anyone that has been abused, who is anyone that has started to lead different roads parallel to each other, who has had to split their parts of themselves in order to survive, who's had to disassociate and still disassociates. You know, I'm talking about myself in the third person, but I'm also talking to listeners who will have experienced similar. And I'm talking to people who've not experienced it and trying to explain, I guess, why PTSD is something that I think more people need to understand and learn about. I have CPTSD, complex PTSD, and it means if something triggers me, and I, you know, that word trigger is thrown around the place sometimes and it makes people turn off. But if something triggers me, if I suddenly am feeling really unsafe and out of control, there is a whirlwind of silence mixed with this kind of high-pitched noise goes starts in my ears. My stomach is in knots. And I go into panic and I start reacting from a place of panic. And that can turn into anger, that can turn into dread, that can turn into having to run away. Previous relationships, I would have gotten into cars and driven away in the middle of an argument. I also would have done the thing where if somebody stops talking to me, following them around the house, please don't answer me, talk to me, and getting angrier and angrier, or more upset and distraught. I can, you know, panicky. And everything is my identity and my body trying to make it safe again.
And as an adult, what are the tools that you're using? Can you feel, if you feel this coming on now, what do you know to do? Or is there anything you can do?
There are things you can do. It's taken a lot of self-awareness. And the thing is, when your proper PTSD stuff is triggered, your self-awareness is out the window. There's no, like, your cognitive part of your brain can say, you know that this is, you're on the road somewhere here, stop. But depending on how afraid my identity is, how afraid I am in that moment, I could be half an hour, I could be an entire day. The tools that I've used, I think I have a sense of awareness anyway. I don't know where that comes from. Like, everyone has a sense of awareness, but I think I had it from a young age. And I think because I had to split stuff, I think I learned how to talk to myself to go through things. I also did a course, a self-development course, a number of years ago called the Landmark Forum, which definitely helped me to be able to separate out the stuff I made up about myself and therefore allowed to control my life versus the who I am and who I want to be in the world. And then I'm in therapy at the moment, and my therapist specializes in attachment theory and early childhood trauma. And attachment theory really appeals to me because I was first and foremost, from a tiny baby, attached to my dad. So an awful lot of my issues have stemmed from the fact that my attachment to my dad clearly has not served me well, you know. And so it's really interesting looking at the ways in which my self wants to cope in situations. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. And I suppose too, Kate, it's to impart from your own personal experience for anybody who's listening to this, and a lot of what you've said is resonating with them, that the importance of starting to take control of your own narrative and the importance of reaching out and speaking to somebody.
Yeah. And like, the thing is, reaching out and speaking to somebody could mean writing a letter to yourself. You know, if you can arrange yourself in such a way that it feels outside of yourself, that you can start to verbalize something. I told my best friend in primary school about what was happening to me, and she carried that with me for a number of years. And that, I think, really helped, because I always had someone to sort of, some outlet to share it with. But there are people who have contacted me. There's a lot of men who have contacted me, and they've said they've never told anyone and they never will. But the thing that they've forgotten is they've just told me. Or there's a lot of people who will contact me and go, I see you, or I hear you. And that's their way of saying me too. Whatever way you find to express it is healthy, and it's a start. And the thing is, it's a poison inside you. And people would have said that to me years ago, and I'm like, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm not messed up. Because all I had was, you're such a fuck up, you're such a head fuck, you're a messed up human being.
But this was your narrative in your head.
Yeah. And it's like, I'm not any of those things. I will fuck up, I'm a human. I will make mistakes, I will piss people off, I will choose to do something that is out of integrity. Do you know what I mean? I have a nasty streak, I have a kind streak, I have all of the things that make up a human. And you're not just one thing that happened to you, and you are not the things you tell yourself, because ultimately the things you tell yourself are what someone else made you believe when you were little.
Get the fuck machine turned on.
I don't know how you can't get the machine turned on.
I hope that we get. Okay. So that was recorded earlier today, and yeah, guys, it was a lot.
Yeah, it was a lot. And thank you for staying with us and, you know, keeping on listening. Again, just to reiterate, if you've been affected or moved by any of the topics that were raised, namely the abuse, you can go on to the website Carrie, C-A-R-I, so it's cari.ie, www.carrie.ie, carry.ie. And the other big thing that we're looking for, we're final push on getting the podcast funded. So if you've got a few spare bob, the GoFundMe page is there live. We've raised nearly €2,600.
Mm-hmm.
Our target is 3,500. So anything that you could donate would be brilliant. Go to GoFundMe/WeStandPodcast.
Next time on We Stand, Kate will take us to the moment that she discloses to her mum about the abuse. We'll also hear from Kate's mum, Mari, about how that moment changed their lives.
It's when they actually drove away, just around the corner, the car pulled out of sight, and I thought, oh Jesus.